Good evening. The House votes to overturn, or is about to vote to overturn, Trump's national emergency. Michael Cohen is grilled on day one of his testimony about his former boss, President Trump, and a case before the Supreme Court that may have a drastic effect on a community broadcaster. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, February 26, 2019. And President Trump got another taste of divided government Tuesday as the democratically controlled House of Representatives moved towards passing a resolution blocking his declaration of a national emergency along the southern border. The measure would then move to the Senate, where it will require only a simple majority, the equivalent of four Republican defections, to be sent to the White House for the president's inevitable veto. Forcing Trump to use his veto pen for the first time in his presidency would represent a show of force from newly empowered Democrats. The resolution is marked as privilege under the National Emergencies Act. That means Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell will have 18 days to put a vote on the floor that will force his members to publicly choose either to protect Congress's spending authority as a co-equal branch of government or show their support for the president and his goal of securing the border. New York Representative Hakeem Jeffries says the measure to end the national emergency is necessary because the president is not a king.
With respect to the resolution of disapproval, and we are urging our colleagues to not just talk the talk with respect to the House as a separate and co-equal branch of government, but walking the walk. The president in this particular instance is behaving more like a king. That is inconsistent with what James Madison and the Founding Fathers expected out of the executive branch. The Founding Fathers were clear that when the executive branch overreaches, it's the job of the United States Congress as a separate and co-equal branch of government to serve as a check and balance. The resolution of disapproval with respect to Donald Trump's fake national emergency is consistent with that constitutional responsibility. That is what we're focused on right now.
And Jeffries went on to compare Trump to a member of a criminal underworld.
Well, the American people deserve to know whether Donald Trump has been functioning as the president of the United States of America or as the equivalent of an organized crime boss. Michael Cohen can shed some light on that very important question.
Jeffries went on to denounce Trump's wall on the southern border as a remnant of ancient times,
Right now, we're focused on dealing with this man-made, manufactured, manipulative, so-called national emergency that is really just designed to fulfill a campaign applause line connected to a medieval border wall that the president claimed Mexico would pay for it. This whole thing is outrageous and it's inconsistent with the United States Constitution and the allocation of the power of spending to the Congress.
The representative added the reason the House is voting to shut down Trump's emergency is that its rationale is based on lies.
The president's declaration is a phony, fraudulent, and fake national emergency. There is no crisis at the border. The president's actions are manufactured, manipulative, and represent a misappropriation of taxpayer resources inconsistent with the United States Constitution. There is no crisis at our southern border. There is no basis in law or in fact to declare a national emergency. There is no increase in illegal crossings at our border. There is no increase in criminal activity at our border. There is no increase in drug trafficking at our border. There is no evidence that terrorists are coming into the United States of America along our southern border. President Donald Trump has more stories than Harry Potter, and all of them are make-believe. That is why House Democrats are proceeding with a resolution of disapproval with respect to this fake national emergency.
And Jeffries, speaking of the Michael Cohen hearings that began today before the House Oversight Committee, said it's time to shine a light into the dark recesses of Trump's mind.
Well, Justice Brandeis has made the point that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Clearly, there's no one closer to Donald Trump with respect to his business practices, not month after month, not year after year, but decade after decade, than Donald Trump and his relationship with Michael Cohen. And so what we need to hear from Michael Cohen is that information presented in a transparent fashion, and the American people can make a decision from there.
That's Representative Hakeem Jeffries. And former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen was officially disbarred today. He pleaded guilty to both lying to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and to campaign finance violations. He was in Washington behind closed doors testifying again before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Cohen will start a three-year prison sentence in May. Republican Roy Blunt of Missouri told reporters afterwards that most of the questioning was about what lies Cohen had previously told Congress. Presumably, this would include telling the Senate Intelligence Committee that discussions of building a Trump Tower in Moscow ended in 2016. Congress later pleaded guilty to lying to Congress, admitting the discussions had lasted for months beyond to fit Trump's political messaging. Susan Collins of Maine added that Cohen received an extensive grilling by the committee. She said Cohen surprised her. She said he's a different guy now. Cohen will testify again on Wednesday, but this time in public and before the House Oversight Committee. He will reportedly accuse Trump of criminal activity while in office, also bringing documents with him and discussing Trump's alleged lies, racism, and cheating. Retired judge and legal commentator Bill Blum says Cohen's testimony will be historic and reveal corruption unlike any the nation has ever seen before.
It's definitely not normal, but very little about the Trump administration is normal. And Michael Cohen's testimony could be pivotal to the legal future of the 45th president, because Cohen may very well implicate Trump directly in crimes, a series of crimes. One would be the campaign violations, which were allegedly committed in paying the hush money to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. Another would be in ordering Cohen to lie to Congress in his previous testimony about Trump's plans to build an office tower in Moscow. So the president is on the hook for that, and more generally for testimony about the business practices of his organization, which probably would include testimony that would relate to possible tax fraud. So this is a very serious development, and I think that Trump and his supporters are as worried about Cohen's testimony, if not more so, than they are worried about the Mueller report.
There's never been a sitting president indicted, and the general belief is that it wouldn't be done. Not that it couldn't be done, but it wouldn't be done. What is that, since the last time we talked, have you changed your thinking on that?
No, I haven't changed my thinking on it. There is no case law on the subject. The Supreme Court has never weighed in on that topic. And presently, the Justice Department has a policy developed on the basis of two Office of Legal Counsel memos, one produced during the Watergate era and the other in 2000, which advised that a president should not be indicted while he is in office, because to do so would disrupt the entire executive branch, and that if any indictments are to be made, they should be made after the president leaves office. We have the example of Nixon being listed as an unindicted co-conspirator by Jaworski in the Watergate controversy. So we don't have an example of a president actually being indicted. The only historical example that I've read about is Ulysses S. Grant being cited by District of Columbia police for speeding, driving his carriage at an excessive speed through the streets of Georgetown in D.C. Another possibility is that the president, who was based in New York when he did many of these things that are alleged, could be prosecuted in New York State by New York authorities. The OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, memoranda do not rule that out. And were that to happen, the argument on behalf of Trump would be that state prosecutors ought to cooperate with the feds under what's called the doctrine of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, or cooperation, and also defer prosecution of the president. Yet another aspect of this whole picture is that we do know that vice presidents can be prosecuted while in office. We have an example of Spiro Agnew. So this is still up in the air, and the issue is now being debated again because of Donald Trump and his rampant corruption before he acceded to office as president and during his presidency.
Does he beat Warren G. Harding and Ulysses S. Grant and Teapot Dome scandal and all those kind of things?
Well, we've had lots of scandals, but we haven't had a federal felony prosecution of a sitting president. And, you know, we're pushing the limits here. Would the Supreme Court uphold such a prosecution? They would have to conclude that the president, by virtue of something in the structure of the Constitution itself, would endow the president with temporary immunity while in office. And you can think of lots of hypotheticals that would make that principle seem pretty absurd. Suppose the president actually murdered someone. Suppose Donald Trump actually shot someone dead on Fifth Avenue, committing cold-blooded murder. Are we to assume that the president would stay in office until he leaves in order to face murder charges?
Andrew Jackson.
It can get pretty absurd.
What about Paul Manafort? What does he face? What's happening to him?
Well, Paul Manafort's going to be sentenced shortly in D.C., and from what I've read, the authorities in New York are going to bring tax and money laundering charges against him in because they believe he's violated New York law, which incidentally would also ensure that a pardon from Trump would not save him.
Could Trump pardon himself?
That is another very interesting question. You know, the crazier he gets, the more interesting it is for people like me who write about constitutional law, because we're now writing about hypotheticals that we would have laughed at decades ago. Can he pardon himself? Maybe he can. I don't think he can, because a pardon is an act of grace that's conferred upon someone who is guilty or is about to be tried. But I don't know that there is anything in the Constitution itself, in the text, that would preclude that. But people are debating that issue.
Bill Blum writes for Truthdig. He's a retired judge and was a former death penalty attorney based in Los Angeles. Republicans have dismissed Cohen's testimony as meaningless since he lied to Congress in the past. The White House said Tuesday it's laughable that anyone would take a convicted liar like Cohen at his word and pathetic to see him get given yet another opportunity to spread his lies. And the U.S. State Department refused more than 37,000 visa applications in 2018 due to the Trump administration's travel ban, up from less than 1,000 the previous year when the ban had not fully taken effect. According to agency data released on Tuesday, previous year when the ban had not, the United States denies nearly 4 million visa applications a year for a variety of reasons, including for practicing polygamy, abducting children, or simply not qualifying for the visa in question. The data released Tuesday was the first comprehensive look at the human impact of Republican President Donald Trump's ban, imposed shortly after he took office and initially blocked by the federal courts. The ban has especially affected people from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, countries where the number of visas issued slid 80%. Trump's initial January 2017 executive order banning entry to the United States by citizens of several Muslim-majority countries launched a fierce fight in federal court over whether the policy amounts to an unlawful Muslim ban or is a legal exercise of presidential power. The administration revised the policy following court challenges, and the Supreme Court allowed it to largely go into effect in December 2017, while legal challenges continued. In 2018, the High Court upheld a new version of the ban. And in other national news that may have some impact upon us here in New York, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Manhattan in the case called Manhattan Community Access Corporation versus Halleck on Monday to decide whether a private nonprofit public access television channel can be sued for violations of the First Amendment. The case originates from a 2016 lawsuit brought by two public access television producers against MNN. That's called Manhattan Neighborhood Network, the operator of the public access TV channels in Manhattan. In 2012, the two producers, Dee Dee Halleck and Jesus Melendez, created a video that was highly critical of MNN. The video aired once but was banned immediately after airing. Halleck and Melendez sued MNN and its employees, alleging a violation of their First Amendment rights. Robert Perry is attorney for the plaintiffs, Halleck and Melendez. He says MNN is a government-controlled entity and therefore must limit its role in editing the speech of public access producers.
Our argument is, our position is that the public access channels in Manhattan are a public forum created by the city of New York pursuant to the franchise agreements with Time Warner. Now it's, I gather, Spectrum has taken over. But it was the agreements with Time Warner that required Time Warner to set aside these channels for public access purposes, and that was required actually also by the state Public Service Commission regulations, which require municipalities in New York to set aside, to require in franchise cable franchising to set aside channels for public access. We maintain this is public property, by the way. There's at least an easement in these channels, even if the cable systems are privately owned. There's at least an easement in these channels. It's a quid pro quo for giving cable operators the right to dig up the streets to construct their, and operate their cable systems. And because these cable channels for public access in Manhattan are a public forum, and because MNN was designated by Manhattan Neighborhood Network to operate, that to administer these channels, they're a state actor. If the city had on its own decided to just regulate the public access channels, no one would quibble that the city was subject to First Amendment constraints, that it was a state actor. The city shouldn't be able to avoid those responsibilities by delegating this public function to a private entity.
Now, the other argument is that this is that they're a. The other argument on the other side is they say that MNN is really more like a utility, like the electric company or like the phone company or like the cable company itself, and as such can be regulated not really as from free speech perspective, but in other perspective, quality of service and things like that.
Well, public forums are almost by definition they're government created. They are by definition government created, and MNN is the public function that it performs is much different than the functions that public utilities perform. We don't have a history in the United States of government running all. By providing all utility service. We do have a history in the United States of government providing all public forums, government-created public forums. So it's like you're mixing apples and oranges. Utility companies perform functions that, while they do have public, they are public functions, but they're not exclusively and traditionally public functions because utility service has been offered for many years by private entities. But public forums like parks and streets, they're always created by government, and they're operated, and they've traditionally and exclusively been administered.
And that was Robert Perry, who's an attorney for Halleck in the MNN case, Halleck and Mendez in the MNN case that we're discussing. One of the two plaintiffs in the case, Jesus Papalito Mendez, a founder of the New Eurekan Poets Cafe on the Lower East Side and a poet in his own right. He says he just wanted to produce a program that featured local poetry and had no idea he'd wind up before the United States Supreme Court.
We took them to court in Second Circuit, and it was... I guess he threw it out of court, and we appealed that and we won the appeal. I was impressed by that. I thought that was a good thing, and I thought that was the end of it. But then they appealed, and they took it all the way to yesterday, which was a very interesting day.
Right. What was it like yesterday?
Well, the decorum of the whole thing was very proper. The proceedings were very casual, like a conversation, as our lawyer, Paul, spoke about later. It was interesting to be in the presence of the Supreme Court, you know, watch government in action like that, and the tour groups that came to be part of the gallery as well, and the way the lawyers were dealing with each other. There was this whole genteel thing about it, even though...
I have to go now because I have another interview lined up, but could you tell me in a brief minute or so, just like in 1 minute, could you tell me what you would like to achieve from this in the end?
Well, you know, this is not a money case. This is a case about principle, and the principle being the violation of the First Amendment, free speech, the Constitution. And I would like to see that is resolved, that a private organization cannot just come and bogart these airwaves at the expense of a city venue like Public Access and then dictate what's going to be aired. It's a way of the government, if we look at it in a broader sense, circumventing their own responsibility to the First Amendment by, passing it off to another group that has no responsibility to it.
Jesus Mendez, one of the plaintiffs in the case. But the lawyer for Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Michael DeLue, who argued the case before the court, says MNN is really not part of the government.
Our board is independent. The Manhattan Borough president has the ability to nominate, but not to place on our board, but an ability to nominate two out of our 13 board members. So the vast majority of our board is independent. Our funding comes not from the city. It comes from the cable operators in Manhattan, and that's negotiated directly between MNN and the cable operators. So the money is not coming from the city. That's not accurate. That's part of the factual background.
Some of the more liberal justices seem to look askance at your argument, saying that maybe this is a way that the government could get around free speech rights by handing it over to a private company, and that maybe that private company should be seen as a government agent.
Well, so a few things. I don't think that the liberal justices were looking askance at my arguments. I think that there were lots of different points. It was a spirited discussion. I think that there are a lot of complex legal issues involved. In terms of the ability for the city to get out of constitutional obligations, I don't think that's true at all. The traditional idea of a public forum and the traditional public fora that are around the city are, you know, the streets and sidewalks and parks, and there's no one is suggesting that the city is avoiding liability on anything like that. Furthermore, you know, if the city operates the government and education channels and is responsible for those, the government has other speech that it controls, and there's no chance of ducking liability for any of the speech that is properly considered in a public forum, in a constitutional public forum. If they think that we are not living up to our obligations of under the State Public Service Commission, they have a perfectly good ability to go to the Public Service Commission and say that we have operated our channels incorrectly.
And DeLue insists that MNN provides a community service and does not discriminate against any programmers.
There are cases at the Supreme Court going back 50 years that say that funding from the government is not enough to make a private entity into part of a government. Or additionally, pervasive regulation by the government is not enough to make a private company a part of the government or a state actor for any of these purposes. So it's important to know the difference. And there's a great line between private action and government action that people from all stripes of the political background, religious backgrounds, philosophical backgrounds, should respect that line. The people don't want to wake up and find that they're part of the government. It's not something that is consistent with the way that most of us want to live our lives.
And that's Michael Deleu, who is the attorney for Manhattan Neighborhood Network, in their lawsuit that came before the Supreme Court this week, deciding whether or not Manhattan Neighborhood Network, because it receives some government support, is a government entity that must allow freedom of speech, or whether it is a private entity that can edit and take people off the air or put them on the air at its will. So drivers entering Midtown and Lower Manhattan would have to pay a congestion charge to help fund repairs to New York City's deteriorating subway system under a plan announced on Tuesday by Mayor Bill de Blasio and New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo has long favored the new toll to generate revenue for an aging subway system that has been plagued by delays and closures. The mayor, who had favored raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers rather than congestion pricing, said he was dropping his opposition. He said, "I still believe a millionaire's tax provides the best, most sustainable revenue source for the transit improvements our city needs, but the time to act is running out, and among all alternatives, congestion pricing has the greatest prospects for immediate success. Under the plan, which requires approval from the state legislature, most people who drive into the island of Manhattan below 61st Street, roughly everything south of Central Park, will have to pay a toll. The toll amounts are to be set by the end of the year." And that's some of the news for Tuesday, February 26, 2019. The news was produced with Jessica Brockington and engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York. A programming note, tomorrow on WBAI and later and throughout the week, we'll be covering the House Oversight Committee's hearings with Michael Cohen.